Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Murphy moves approval of the minutes from February 21st, 2017. Are there any changes proposed? No changes proposed. All those in favor of adoption of the minutes from February 21st, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Representative Baker brings us House File 696. Representative Baker, welcome to the committee. I will go ahead and move House File 696 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. The bill is before the committee. Representative Baker, I don't see, but the bill is as you bring it. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I do believe there is one amendment here that's presented. Is that accurate? I think it is.
Yep, that's Representative Loeffler's. We will wait until she comes and bring that A2 up when she gets here. But if you'd like to introduce the bill, we can get moving.
We can do that, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you very much. House File 696 is an important bill because we've got a lot of folks out in Minnesota that are working really hard in home and community-based settings that there's a tremendous work shortage. And these folks are working really hard and they're not getting paid enough. I'm working through the Best Life Alliance with AARM and all the folks that are working hard to make sure that we do some better things. What House File 696 does, members, is to reduce some of the regulations to provide a way that we can fill these gaps. We have about nearly 9,000 workers that are needed to fill our worker slots out there in Minnesota, and we're trying to find some several policies that can remove the barriers so we can address these workforce shortages. We must do everything we can to support these 9,000 openings for direct care people, and across Minnesota, our home care-based folks need our help. Overtime is up by more than 40%, and that is really also affecting their budgets. With me today, Mr. Chair and members, is Ms. Tanner, and Mr. Chair, I'll let her take it from here.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Barb Turner. I'm with ARMS. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. So since this is the Finance Committee, I'll give you a kind of high overview, and if you have then any specific questions. So I do have kind of a line-by-line breakdown, so it feels a little more intimidating than it is, just because things have to go in multiple places. So starting out with line 314, we have language here that just extends the period of time for which we can use the option of having a fifth-bed variance. So that would allow a four-bed home to go to five beds, if indeed all the people who live there were in agreement that they were willing to be in a five-bed setting. Provision is set to sunset at the end of June of this year, and so we're asking for another two-year extension to that. And then starting on line 4.5 through 8.3, there's a lot of language in multiple places there that basically does one simple thing, which is clarifies the responsibility for doing background studies for child foster care employees, and it's current practice, so this language simply puts into statute what the current practice is. So counties have responsibility for traditional family foster care background studies for children, and the commissioner has responsibility for what we would call corporate child foster care. So that's what all of those lines do. Lines 9.3, that area kind of goes together. We're trying to do two things. We have a new definition of natural support, and then we define the difference between a volunteer and a natural support by having that definition. And what we're attempting to do here is allow for people to have friends and acquaintances of the community interact with people and not have those individuals necessarily be considered officially volunteers, because there are training requirements and background study requirements for people who are official volunteers. So we're trying to delineate between a friend or a neighbor who wants to take someone to a ball game, or someone who actually is in official capacity overseen by the license holder. Line 10.27 adds a new service that is currently at CMS in our amendment waiver, hopefully to be approved, individualized home supports, and later on in the bill you'll see it in other places where it simply has to be inserted in order for us to be able to implement that service. And then line 12.21 13.12. There's a number of additional rights included in this language. Most of these are things that will keep us in compliance with our transition plan, which is what we need to submit and be in compliance with CMS in order to continue to be eligible for waiver dollars. Line 15.4, this is, again, language that assures people receiving services have control over their schedule. Again, this will put us, keep us in compliance with our HCBS transition plan. Line 15.10, this is one of the more important lines, areas we think. What this section does is require that during planning meetings, there's a requirement to discuss how technology might be utilized to meet the service needs of the individual who they're planning for. It doesn't require that technology actually be used or be implemented, but it requires that initial discussion. And ARM's committed to having resources available, so assuming this passes, the teams will have a resource to go to be able to pull up some information so they can have those discussions, because it's hard to have a discussion if you don't have any idea what you're discussing. So we'll have those resources available and continue to add to those resources ongoingly. Line 15.23, as it's written currently, does two things. One, it extends the orientation period for new staff from 60 to 90 days, and it also allows for people to not have a set number of orientation hours, but instead have to be approved competency in all of the areas that are listed in that statute. And the reason for that extension of 90 days is, as we are in a hiring crisis and are having to hire an even more diverse the type of employee, there are some people that just learn differently, and sometimes they need to read something and then see it on site and read something and see it on site, and so having an extended period of time would help in that process. There are still a lot of requirements that have to be, compliance has to, or competency has to be shown before someone can work with the individual or work alone with the individual. None of that would change, so the extension to 90 days wouldn't change any of those things that have been identified as core pieces that people are required to do, but there are other trainings that need to be done that could be extended over a longer period of time. Line 16.28 is language that would allow the commissioner to approve online training with competency-based assessments. And again, this is to give another alternative to how we do training. Right now it's all hourly-based, and in this system it would be competency-based with approved training and approved curriculum from the commissioner. Line 17.32 has to do with requiring a signed residency agreement for people who receive services where the license holder is in essence also responsible for where they live. And this, again, will put us in compliance with our with the HCBS final rule requirements and our transition plan. 18.10 requires that if someone shares a bedroom, they have to have choice of roommates for the bedroom. So, this is part of the CMS final rule in our transition plan. So it's not that you have to approve everyone. If you live in a house, you don't have to approve everyone who lives in the house, but if you have to share a bedroom, you have to have choice of who you're going to share that bedroom with. Line 19.17 requires that a person be allowed to lock their bedroom door and that they have a key to do that and decide who else has keys. Again, that is to put us in compliance with the CMS final rule. And just so that you know, the CMS final rule does allow, if there's a reason that someone shouldn't have a key or shouldn't have a door locked, there are ways to do planning for that. But it, in essence, there's an assumption that people can have that, and then you work to impose restrictions if necessary. Lines 20.34, 23.10, and 24.29 all have to do with ensuring that people have options to meet their needs that include services that aren't that are non-disability specific. And then the next section of changes are 256B revisions. 26.3, this clarifies that services added after January 1st, 2014 aren't subject to rate stabilization adjustment. 27.3 adds the new service that I mentioned earlier, so it just adds it to the rate setting system. 28.21 establishes codes to be used for determining the rate of that new service under the DWS rate setting system. 31.25 adds that new service to the list of unit-based services available under DWRS. And 33.23 clarifies that the new service is not subject to budget neutrality.
All right. I see that Representative Loeffler has joined us, and Representative Loeffler moves the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did have a chance to talk to Representative Baker about this, and this deals with the proposal that would have delayed the timeline by which someone had to be trained in all the aspects of their job from 60 days to 90 days, and as Representative Baker and others have testified, this industry is under tremendous stress right now with incredibly high turnover with some of our most vulnerable populations, some of whom are not able to speak up and advocate on their behalf with their new staff people. And things can happen on day one and when you work in one of these sorts of places. So I was not willing to delay to 90 days the training of them in everything. I know that we were assured by Ms. Turner that they would have the basic training to do their job. But no one knows what to expect and what's going to happen. And I will just say that I was conservative for an aunt who, when she first moved out into a group home for the first time in her life in her 60s and spent a night outside of a family home, I was awoken at 4 a.m. She's saying she'd had a grand mal seizure, and what hospital did I want her taken to? And I said, you know, are you sure you got the right roommate? I'm describing her. She's never had seizures. Oh, yeah. And it may have been a stress seizure from just the stress of moving to a new place. And the one thing that this brand-new staff person said to me is, I'm so glad they showed me that video. I knew exactly what to do. I knew what was happening. And so I just really think we need to make training a priority. And I think 2 months within hire is an adequate time. And I appreciate Representative Baker and working with me on this.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Baker, anything to the A2?
No, Mr. Chair. I guess, again, fair conversations with the folks involved. It still allows some flexibility there with these folks that are doing this every single day, but I do hear what Representative Loeffler is saying. I can agree with this. It'll work with us, so we will be happy to accept that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Any other questions or discussions about the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Baker, to your bill as adopted, as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess I'm here to take questions if there's any. We don't have any other testifiers. Again, this just helps folks that are squeezed and pushed to deliver more with less, provides a little bit more wiggle room. And we appreciate the ability to have this seen. I think we're going to stop at civil law next. That is our pathway. And so we'll continue to do that. And I appreciate your support, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, I just have a question about the definition of natural support. And it's on 9.3 of the bill. And so I think I understand what this is intended to do, but there's nothing here that I see that says that this is a person who's unpaid. And since we're differentiating them from a volunteer, I'm assuming that that is intended. It's intended to be an unpaid person, but I don't see where it says that. Can you help me out here?
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think I might have Ms. Turner answer that. I think what we are intending to do here is to obviously make it easier so that volunteers and folks that want to take a person to a ball game don't have to go through the background checks. That's obviously the point. If it's needed to have it as a listed as a volunteer, but I'll have Ms. Turner speak to that.
Ms. Turner.
So it does not speak to it in the language, but the intent is that a natural support is a non-paid individual like a volunteer, but different in that it's not a formal position that's overseen by the license holder. So volunteers, by definition in other parts of statute, are people that the license holder has some responsibility for what's happening and how it's happening. Natural supports would be different than that, so that it would be, again, presumably included in a person's plan if they're able to be away from the license holder. So it's individuals who are not paid, who are engaged in the person's life and activities.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Turner, I think that since we're talking about statutory language here, if it's intended that this is a person who's not paid, I think that needs to be changed, fixed. Because I don't know if somewhere else in the bill it defines this or somewhere else in law natural support is defined, but under this language, it could be somebody who's paid but just not under the supervision of this license holder or license holder's representative. So the person could be going out hiring another person to take them to a ball game. I don't think that's what's intended here. I think you mean that people with disabilities should be able to have a friend.
That's exactly what.
And I think that's great, you know, great. I just want to make sure that this is what is said here so that we're not unintentionally creating a hole. So if it's intended to be an unpaid person, I would suggest, since we have a 24-hour rule in committee, I can't make an amendment, but I think it needs that correction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker.
I think that's a valid point and a well taken. I think that what we can do is, between now and our next stop, we'll talk to the department about that and see if it's something we need to add for clarification. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And I had kind of a question about the same thing. So many times the department will come forward with recommendations and changes about the set-asides and the background studies. And we have a lot of interest around vulnerable Minnesotans and make sure that the people taking care of them are checked and it's a safe environment for particularly for vulnerable people. So would this change if I'm a person who is very concerned about that people who should not have contact or with vulnerable Minnesotans, that there would be any supervisory position or any time where they're under care of a volunteer that they would be vulnerable. So, for example, in other instances, I think we've had recommended changes for folks who work at nursing homes, that the people who work in maintenance or the grounds crew wouldn't have to have set-asides and those kinds of things, and see it as a relaxing of that. And I just don't want to make, I want to make sure that we're not doing that in this case. Is there some way you can assure me that that's, I know that's not the intent, but is there anything that we're doing here that would create a situation that could potentially be less safe for people because we're not doing the background studies that we should?
Well, if I'm going to be totally honest, if you're allowing people to have friends in the community and you aren't requiring a background study, the likelihood that there's some chance that something bad could happen, the answer would be yes, that's possible. But people who want to have experiences in the community, we believe need to have take reasonable risks. So we're not indicating, our bill is not, the intention of that language isn't that anyone who comes knocking at the door and says, hey, do you have anyone who I can take to a ball game, would say, sure, take Joe, he'd love to go. But we're talking about situations where within a plan, first of all, someone would have to be able to be in a situation where the license holder didn't have to be responsible for them 24 hours a day. So there are people who have alone time and time they can go out in the community and do whatever they want, Without the license holder being overseeing them. Okay, we have people, we serve many people like that. This bill would allow them to do then activities with people who they know or who know them or who are part of their, you know, circle, without having to have that considered a volunteer position. So it might be a neighbor who has an extra ticket to a ball game. And he knows Joe because he lives next to Joe, and he says, I'd take Joe to a ball game. Right now, because of fear of who's responsible and is someone responsible, those situations, normally we say, oh, if you're going to take Joe out, you have to have a background study, and we have to go through this training with you. It kind of eliminates the ability for people to have friends because not many friends want to go through a background study and a training in order to simply be a friend. And so, legitimately, yes, is there any opening the door that something bad could happen? Sure. I can't say that there isn't.
But I don't understand why we need a law that says that, or obviously you'd have family members, right, that you would, that this is currently, currently taking folks out and going to church and doing whatever. But I don't understand why, who said that this should be a, that we need a law for this? And, I mean, are there instances where this is not happening, or I just don't want this to be used as an excuse for people not to provide the care that we're paying them to do, and if they're under the care and supervision of others, that we don't allow for a door to bypass that, particularly for vulnerable folks. And I don't want to stop the opportunity for people to have fun and go to a ball game and do what they want to do. I did not spot that earlier. I apologize, and I just want to be reassured before we move this along that is tightened and we understand the parameters around it.
Mr. Chair, maybe I hear you. I think that what we don't want to see happen is the natural supports, the volunteers are all going to turn to natural supports. And I think that's a very valid point, and I think it's something that we need to examine. That's not the intent here at all. But again, there are times when a neighbor or a friend of somebody can take somebody fishing for the day, and again, to do the background checks and everybody just isn't simply always easy to do and in the cards. And I think this is still again, these are trusted families. These are trusted businesses that also run these homes. But I feel that they need to be given some leeway with to make sure that it's not as difficult to hire people. So that would be my only comment in that.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was going to be on a different topic, but I did want to weigh in on this, and that we did authorize as a state one of the first ABLE programs before the federal regulations were even out on that allows family members to establish what are like 529 college savings programs for children with disabilities. And and that money is not to be used to supplant their MA expenses. It can't be claimed against in any way by the state. And so we're going to end up with some clients in the future who have substantial assets that can only be used for their entertainment or extras. And I can see where a family member might say, you know, my daughter loves musicals. She can't watch them enough on DVD, and I'm going to make sure that for the rest of her life she has a subscription, and we're going to pay someone to make sure that she gets to every single touring Broadway show that comes to the cities. And that will be set up in the arrangements that are made available to that person to enhance their life and to add things that couldn't normally be in their basic limited budget and range of services. And so I think that we have to be careful also in terms of limiting it to people who are not paid, because I think we're going to be seeing people having experiences in their life in which they're going to be using these 529 programs, whether it's just to pay the Lyft driver to take them downtown or whatever it is. And so I think we need to be careful. My question was, since this is the budget committee, I noticed that there's a number of provisions related to we have added at least one new service. And then we have a couple of provisions on page 26 and 30 that say that any new service added after it, it's a retroactive date, as I recall, is not subject to budget neutrality. And it seems to me, I just want to have some discussion about what does that mean for our budget and developing new services. Lines 33.23, a service rate developed using values is not subject to neutrality. There's several different places throughout this that has a reference to not applying the current rate stabilization adjustment, other provisions. And I just wanted to know, are we saying that any new service is going to be totally rated differently? And I didn't see some language that says how we're going to set the prices. So the department has to answer that, or if our witness here can. But I just felt like we should understand what are we laying as the groundwork for the future.
Representative Loeffler, committee members, I'll try and answer, and if I mess up, maybe the department will have to step in. But the intent of the language, the budget neutrality factor that was part of the DWS system as it was established was intended to be based on those services that were in place at the time of the development of the system. So as new services come in, it's something that doesn't apply to them simply because it's a different, there's nothing to be neutral on because there wasn't that service before. And so it's
as these new services are coming on, it expands the availability of types of services, but doesn't increase the dollars that would necessarily be available. So there's not more dollars simply because there's another service. It's just another option that people could choose amongst an array of options. So we, as we've gone through this with, we don't believe there is any kind of fiscal note to this bill, good or bad. I think it's a neutral. And so that's the best I can explain it off the top of my head. And I can certainly ask the department to do a better job if they think I didn't.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am concerned because we are adding a new individualized home supports to the list of 22 services. And I did have a chance to talk to someone from the department yesterday who said they thought this would be actually a less expensive service than some of the ones that we are currently using. But then that would fall within the budget neutrality if it actually is a more cost-effective service. And since we have at times been criticized, I think we heard in the state auditor's report yesterday that we are operating one of the most expensive services systems in the state. We have people less integrated into the community, less into integrated employment and housing situations. We have one of the most expensive service systems. And so part of putting this language in was to kind of keep guiding us towards those more cost-effective and more integrated service systems that other states across the nation have adopted. And so I'm just wondering if we're starting to work against that, and appreciate the department's input.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hamilton. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton. I'm with the Department of Human Services, the Disability Services Division. Prior to adding any service to the waiver programs, we need to do an analysis to determine if it would cost money and if we need additional money from the legislature to do that. With adding individualized home supports, we determined there was no additional cost because it replaces existing services. It's supporting people living in their own home. There are already services supporting people living in their own home. And so this is just a new option to be more flexible and to provide additional support that allowed people to stay in their own home. As far as the budget neutrality language, as Ms. Turner stated, that was language that was added when the disability waiver rate system was implemented when the language passed in 2009, which created created of budget neutrality that in certain areas, so day services, we had to have a budget neutrality within that bucket, and for residential services, and then for unit-based services, and then unit-based services with programming. That was an artificial mechanism to maintain budget neutrality after the disability rate system was determined what the rate should be. And so what this language says is for new services, we are not going to do that artificial increase or reduction to maintain budget neutrality. We are going to fully implement the disability waiver rate system as it says that rate should be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say that we did hear yesterday that we have confusing long lists of services between waiver programs and they're not consistent, and it was hard for the legislative auditor to really wade through all these different service definitions that sounded the same but maybe were a little different. And in this bill, we're adding a new service, individualized home supports, with no definition in the law. And that doesn't mean that the department won't create a definition in its waiver request or elsewhere, but I think we do need to think about this as this moves on as to whether or not we should start taking ownership of every time we add something, actually defining what do we mean. Because to the average layperson, that sounds like other things that are on this list, like housing access coordination, independent living skills, in-home family support, residential care services, residential support services. And it's hard for me, just by the title, to tell how individualized home supports are different than any of those that are already exist on the list and are residential-based. And so I think we need to start taking our work a little bit more seriously in terms of how we define these things, how they overlap or they don't, because otherwise we're at risk, as we are in other areas, of coding for the maximum budget rather than really focusing on this meeting the needs of individuals and being clear about what we're buying.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 696, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 696, as amended, is re-referred.
Thank you, Brittany.
Which one? Back here or McDonald?
Representative McDonald is making his way down for House File 851. Welcome to the committee, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly it's nice to be back here in the Finance Committee, members.
And unfortunately, I will have to move the bill because you didn't rank this committee high enough on your preferences for your choices this year, evidently.
Oh. Mr. Chair, I did. It was an invisible ink. I borrowed my son's.
We miss you. We miss you. I will move House File 851 and see no amendments. House File 851 is before us, Representative McDonald.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 51 appropriates services, is appropriation. It's services for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It appropriates $248,000 for the year 2018 and $248,000 for the years 2019 and going forward. And what this particular bill will do, it will establish a competitive grant for funding for organizations that are governed with people with intellectual and developmentally disabled disabilities that will administer a statewide network of disability groups that will focus on leadership, development, and self-advocacy skills for Minnesotans with disabilities. Here in this various committee and in various areas around the state, there are important conversations taking place about how we can best support Minnesotans with disabilities and help them live meaningful lives in their communities, based on the choices of where they can live, where they can work, and where they can play. These conversations are a result with many innovative ideas for how to move towards this shared goal while using state dollars in the most effective and efficient way, including ideas for reforming existing programs, increasing choice for individuals, and how they use limited dollars. However, the key to our success in supporting Minnesotans with disabilities is for individuals with disabilities themselves advocating for their own lives as to where they want to live, where they want to work, and where they want to play. Whether they advocate takes place within their own family, or in a place of work, or school, or living, or within their own communities, or even here at the Capitol. These grants funds proposed in this bill would support specific activities focused on the development of these leadership and advocacy skills in Minnesotans with disabilities. I know here we are faced with many difficult decisions on how to use precious dollars in the state. I firmly believe that these dollars will be used very efficiently and effectively in ensuring that those with developmental disabilities can live a quality of life just like you and me. With me today is Mary K. Kennedy, who is really the boots on the ground kind of gal that serves the disability community and it works in it every day. She's a champion for the disabled community and a wonderful partner in this endeavor. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn it back to you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kennedy. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Dean and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify on House File 851. My name is Mary Kay Kennedy, and I'm the Executive Director of Advocating Change Together, the Center for Disability Leadership. Due in part to some federal mandates, integration mandates, Minnesota is working to create new strategies that give folks with disabilities the same rights and freedoms as their non-disabled peers and build their capacity to lead these statewide changes. During this session, you will be hearing new ideas to increase choice and opportunity for people with disabilities. It's an exciting time for Minnesota as we are taking the burden off of people with disabilities to change themselves to fit society. And I think we're really just all working very hard as a state to create a society where everyone is respected and included in community life. While we absolutely understand that funding is limited this session, we are compelled to make an argument for why funding is needed to support people with developmental disabilities to be part of the leadership as Minnesota makes service systems changes that affect their life. As people in our community say, nothing about us without us. In the interest of time, I will briefly summarize what the grant funds would be used for. Basically, the funds will be used to maintain and strengthen a network of groups across the state that work directly with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The funds will develop leaders with disabilities to move Minnesota integration mandates forward. It will. I will share just a few of the program features and invite you to to review more of those features in the written text that's been provided. So basically the funds are used, again, to support the infrastructure for the network for peer-led training sessions in all over the state of Minnesota. This network will build awareness of service options related to housing, employment, education, and transportation, and it will also build awareness and knowledge around emerging service reform initiatives, such as the state's Olmstead Plan, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and the new federal home and community-based services. The funds will be used to help connect people with disabilities with others that can help them figure out what their options are and make informed choice if they choose to make a transition in services. And then lastly, I'll just note one more. The funds would help us with statewide conferencing and disability network. So over the years, my organization has made a pretty big commitment in getting outside expertise to help measure what is changing because of the work we do. We conduct environmental scans, create logic models, and create and contract out for program effectiveness assessment for our individual programs. We are happy to share any or all of this data with any of you upon request. But in a nutshell, the assessments do show that we are making a difference and that our methods yield measurable integration and leadership outcomes. In 2015, we conducted an environmental scan, and the scan showed that disability groups across the state, as well as government agencies like DHS, DD Council, D, Disability Law Center, all agree that there is a need to support and grow the efforts in disability leadership and self-direction. The scan reveals that we've accomplished a great deal over the past decade, but we have a ways to go. So the biggest question is not how to build leadership for integration, but the question that we have is really how to finance it. And that's why we're here today. We are asking for a public investment to continue and expand the work. So thank you, members of the committee, for your consideration of this request. It would mean a lot to us.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy, for your testimony. Are there questions for Ms. Kennedy or the bill author? All right. Seeing no further questions, final thoughts, Representative McDonald?
Final thoughts, Mr. Chair, is this is something that is obviously very important to everyone in the room. I shared this with the Reform Committee that I sit on as well. And it's definitely needed in the state, and I hope that we can make sure that this makes it into the omnibus bill. It is a lot of money, but it's a small amount of money. But more important than the financial obligation of the state, it does so many great things with those with disabilities. I'll just share a quick story with you with a cousin of mine. I shared this at the last committee, Tom Early, who lives in the Dells home. It's a group residential house. He has a developmental disability. The advocacy change together, the advocate and change together group, will work with the disabled community to ensure that they can live the quality of life just like any one of us, and that stay in their communities, that can work in their communities, that can be active in their communities. And it engages the community itself to how to work with the disabled community. Wouldn't that be the case, Ms. Kennedy?
Absolutely.
And encourage them to be active in their churches and active in their schools and active in their employment and their communities, and it really lifts the spirits of everyone that's involved, particularly those who don't have the disability. So it's a passion. I think looking at everyone in the committee here and knowing most of you for some time, I know it's dear in your heart as well to do anything we can with the disabled community and help them live a great quality life just like any of us. And there's some folks in the audience here that would certainly are shaking their heads. Kurt, one of them, great man, does a lot of good work. And I just encourage you to support this bill.
Well, thank you, Representative McDonald, for your work on behalf of disabled Minnesotans. And we miss you in the committee. You're always welcome here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 1 o'clock, room 200.
I think my schedule's free.
All right. House File 851 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members.
Next up, we have Jeff Backer, and he's got House File 960.
Transportation bill.
All right, Representative Backer, would you like to move House File 960?
Well, we have two amendments. We'd like to move those first. Oh, well, we got to do the motion. I'm sorry. Yes, we'd like to move that. Yes.
All right.
Well, I'm ahead of myself.
House File 960, and then move for adoption of House File A1.
Yes, and but we also have an A2.
All right, we can move them concurrently. House File A1, A2. Representative Backer.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members. This bill deals with school-link mental health grants, which was first funded in 2007 at the recommendation of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, knowing that 50% of all adults with mental illness began experiencing symptoms at the age of 14. We know it's very important to reach these students early. The Minnesota model is viewed positively around the country. The funding goes out to the community mental health providers, who then works with local schools. They will closely work with the school staff, such as teachers, school support, and other people in the schools. Now, the providers will first bill your insurance, both public and private. The grant funds are used to pay for those activities that are not billable. For example, students that are underinsured or not insured at all. We will, if you also look at, there's a map in your packet. And what this map does is, and we've made great strides in increasing to reaching these students. But currently, if you look way out west where that hump bump tip elbow nose is, Travers and Stevens are two of the counties that are not serviced. So we would hope that with this additional funding, we would be able to help those students and so forth. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sue.
Representative Backer, let's go ahead and adopt both amendments. A1 just removes the delete in page 1, line 7, and inserts $2 million. Is that correct?
That does.
All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. A2, Representative Backer moves the A2 amendment expanding services to school buildings and districts where school-length mental health services are available in less than 50% of the school building. That expands it out as Representative Backer has suggested. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Backer, to your bill as amended. Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I'm really thankful to Representative Backer for this bill. As you know, mental illness is a young person's illness. You know, most of the mental illness develops by the age of 24, so if we wait until they're adults, we have waited too long. The school-linked mental health program in Minnesota is really viewed as a national model because of the way we have set it up. A big thing is that we eliminate barriers to access. So families, whether they're in the metro or rural Minnesota, don't have to worry about transportation. How do I get to the school to get my child to bring them to treatment? They don't have to worry about missing work and actually often losing their jobs. A length of treatment could be 22 weeks. Really hard to take off of work for 22 weeks and pick up your child, bring them to the therapist, and bring them back. Knowing where to go. A lot of families have no idea where to go to access mental health treatment. And then the children are out of school for a longer period of time when you factor in transportation. And then, of course, there's the waiting list. We've created a sustainable model because we bring in private and public insurance as well. We're braiding the funding, so it's not just relying on grant funds. We've estimated that the cost of the grants per student served is $668. So if you think about it, that's a real deal. We evaluate the program. I know you're often talking about what are the outcomes, what happens. We do evaluate. Do they complete their treatment plan? And most of them do. Do they get better? We actually measure their scores in terms of how they're functioning, and the kids are getting better as well. It's a collaborative model. A lot of school social workers and psychologists are not actually clinicians, but we need to work closely with them. And so we're building on their work and kind of adding this other level of service. And a big thing for families is we've created a firewall between those medical records and the school records. We don't think it's the school's responsibility to actually provide clinical treatment, and so this program really helps. I will say that the program is loved by everyone. I do have a packet with some letters that came in over the weekend. kids love it, the families love it, the teachers love it, the principals, the superintendents, the mental health providers, and more. We are actually, the outcomes are excellent. We're actually decreasing suspension rates because kids are getting the help that they need. We're narrowing mental health disparities, which is also good. And frankly, we're just really, truly improving the lives of these students. When the legislature increased the funding in 2013, you can see by the maps that we really did increase the span of the program as well, but we need to do more. We have about 76 districts that have between 1 to 25% of their school buildings with the program, and about 130 have between 26 and 50% of their school buildings. In most schools now, there's actually a waiting list for treatment because, again, it's become very popular and people know it's a way to go for help. One of the problems I learned about on my 40-city tour this fall was that in some areas, some of the programs actually need help with transportation, especially in the very rural areas. So we would also allow these grant programs to be used to pay for transportation in the summer if they need to continue that treatment plan. So again, this is a very successful program, and we've actually brought a parent here today to talk about the impact on her child and her family.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. My name is Sasha, and I'm a mother of a 12-year-old daughter who has received services through the past 3 years through this grant. I am also a third-grade teacher and have students every year benefit from this grant. Last night I shared with both of my daughters that I was coming here today to speak with you, and my oldest, who struggles and is receiving services through the grant, said, "You have to tell them my story. You have to tell them how this has helped me. And just don't tell them my name, but tell them everything. Tell them how I couldn't get out of the bathroom in the morning because she's been diagnosed with anxiety and OCD. And we would go 8 hours in a day where she would be in the bathroom and we just couldn't get her out. And she struggled from birth, and we would make it beyond one stage or difficulty, and then it would open the door to another difficulty that she had. Her anxieties grew to a traumatic level that affected our home, her self-esteem. She felt she was a bad person, and she would finally, when she'd come out of these traumatic moments, she would be so sorry for what she had done and not understand why she did what she did. And it, we went through play therapy, we went through physical therapy, we went through chiropractic therapy. We tried we exhausted all of these areas to help her, and it wasn't until we were introduced to this grant through Lighthouse Child and Family Services in Malacca, Minnesota, that we started to see some changes in her. And that was the end of her third grade, the summer before her fourth grade year. And that August, we didn't know how we were going to get her to school on time starting fourth grade because she just would not come to the bathroom. She wouldn't come out of the bathroom. We had to make all of her appointments later in the day. And she did start fourth grade the first day she made it. The days after, she couldn't make it. She couldn't get out of the bathroom. She just didn't feel right. She didn't feel clean enough. And she did have to spend 21 days in a day treatment center, which cost $25,000. For help, and that helped her because we were able to find what kind of medication she needed that would help her get through this OCD anxiety issues. But the grant and Mandy Anderson that works through Lighthouse has helped her believe in herself and realize that she's okay. There's nothing wrong with her. It's given her the tools that she needs to be successful and to ask for help. And she's not afraid to tell people about the problems that she's gone through, which I think is such an important part of helping the students now at this generation. There isn't that stigma that our generation, my parents' generation, has of mental health issues. And she's smart, she has high aspirations, and the support she's given is going to help her so much in her life. And the families that I work with in my classroom and the students that I've seen go through this program and find more success and start feeling more self-esteem, we're changing lives. And mental health issues aren't going to go away. This illness is here, and we've only touched a small portion of the children that we are dealing with that are going to be growing up and are going to be our next generation. And I'm so thankful for this grant, and I hope it can be increased to help more students.
Thank you, Ms. Corrin. Are there questions for the bill author or for the testifiers? Oh, I'm sorry. We also have a couple more testifiers to come up.
Okay.
Sorry about that. We have Tom Belcher and Mark Sander.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed in whatever order you'd like.
Thank you, Chairman Dean, for the opportunity to testify. My name is Tom Belcher. I'm with Greater Minnesota Family Services. We've been providing school mental health services for over 15 years, the last 8 of which in partnership with DHS as a school linked mental health grantee. Currently, we serve over 1,200 students a year in 42 buildings in 18 school districts over 21 counties in Minnesota. The largest districts we serve are St. Cloud and Marshall, but we also serve quite a few smaller districts in southern and western Minnesota, including 2 school districts in Representative Becker's legislative district. Our programming has expanded from 2 to 45 staff people, and the number of schools where we provide service continue to grow. Despite this, there's still a great deal of unmet need. In the past year alone, we've added services in 9 school buildings, and we're in conversations with several others right now. However, our ability to expand services at this point can't continue without additional state funding. Grantees receive a flat amount of funding over our 5-year contract cycle, and additional services eventually become impossible if the funding cannot be increased. The Schooling Mental Health Grant gives kids mental health services in their school environment, which for many is the only place that they would ever receive these services. Many of the schools we serve are in communities with limited or no other mental health resources. Grant services have a positive impact not only on the lives of children as young people, but also improves their achievement as students and future citizens. In addition, through the Schooling Mental Health Grant, mental health professionals are able to not only treat children, but also serve as consultants and coaches to help teachers deal with challenging behavior. One of the statistics we're proud of is in the first 2 years of our collaboration with the Marshall School District, there was a 22% reduction in school suspensions. This program helps kids cope with their challenges and keeps them in school so they can learn, and we appreciate any support you might be able to offer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sander. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Dear Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and guests, I'm honored to testify here today. My name is Dr. Mark Sander. I hold the joint position with Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. And today I'm testifying on behalf of Hennepin County, Minneapolis Public Schools, and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA. And they are all in full support of this proposal. In 2005, I helped implement the school mental health program in the Minneapolis Public Schools in 5 school buildings. Today, the program is in 48 schools in Minneapolis and in over 150 schools across Hennepin County, which is an exponential growth since 2008, when we were only in 45 schools in Hennepin County. Much of this growth is due to the school mental health grants. In 2015, the Center for School Mental Health, the National Technical Assistance Center for School Mental Health at the University of Maryland, recognized our program here as an exemplar program, and we've have the pleasure of having the National Conference here in 2009, once again recognizing the leader that Minnesota is in school mental health. This past year in Hennepin County, this last school year, the school mental health program has served between 4,000 and 5,000 students that wouldn't have gotten services without the program. The school mental health program significantly increases access and engagement for students and families. Over 50% of the students that are receiving services are receiving services for the very first time. Of those students receiving services for the very first time, we found over 40% were found to have be severely emotionally disabled, which means that they were at risk for out-of-home placement within the next year. So these are students and families that were not able to engage in care for whatever reason, but those students had very significant mental illness. We've also found in Minneapolis that we have parents and teachers report significant mental health improvements for students. We've reduced discipline referrals and suspensions and increased student attendance. This past year, while the research was commissioned by the Children's Mental Health Collaborative of Hennepin County to do a qualitative study of school mental health, where we interviewed both school staff and parents. And I want to just point out some interesting findings from the parents. Parents said because the school and the therapist and the parents worked closely together, the parents felt much more connected to their child's school. The parents reported that 76% of the children felt more connected, felt an improved relationship with their school staff. 75% of the children, of the parents reported that their children were more interested in school. 88% reported that their children had a greater sense of school belonging. And 75% reported that their child was more involved in school. We know that school connectedness is very closely related to increased academic achievement. We believe that there's a significant need to expand these programs. There are many schools that do not have the program and want it, and many schools that have a therapist that are asking for a second one because of the increased need. This is a very cost-effective way to reach students and families with mental health needs. These programs are critical to improving the outcomes for children and family, especially for families that have difficulty accessing community-based care. Thank you very much for the ability to testify today.
Thank you, Dr. Sander. And we'll go to member questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Backer, the intention of this bill. And I'm not sure if this question is for you or for Ms. Abdul-Holden or maybe someone from the Department of Human Services. But I just wanted to ask a question about the distribution of the grants. You gave us this map, which is great, and it shows that there are some parts of the state that either are receiving no grants by county or school district, and some that are receiving very little money. And I'm just curious about how the decisions are being made about where the grant funding is going.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, so the community mental health providers are the ones who actually apply for the grants, and so they have to have an agreement with their local school districts as well. There are some areas where we know some of the school districts were like, no, we're okay, we don't want to do this, and so then they didn't collaborate with that particular school. We have tried to focus as well on poverty because we know that there's an increase and certainly at risk for developing a mental illness, so that's been part of the strategy as well. But I know there is someone here from the department if they wanted to add on to anything that I've said. Looks like I got that one right.
And then, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up question. Thank you, Ms. Abdul-Holden, for that, and again, for you or for the department as I look at this. And then I wonder if we were to look at a map and overlay the incidence of mental illness among school-age students, if the distribution of the funds would match the demand that we might see in terms of incidence, if we're actually through the grant-making process meeting the need that's happening where it is most evident.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there's an overall prevalence rate of mental illness, 1 in 5 children at any given time. Some will have it more serious, some not. you know, I think that if we looked at that, especially in terms of poverty, just that being one factor, I think we would see that we have a greater concentration of mental health programs in those particular buildings. There are some school districts that have actually put in additional funds because they really see the benefit of the program, and so they've added to their particular schools. I do have a chart that shows which districts have the highest concentration of schooling to mental health programs, and I'd be happy to get that for you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Everholden. I'd love to see that information. Of the school districts, in your experience working with this information, are there other factors besides poverty that are being considered? Are we looking at ACE scores? Are we being able to do some assessment in addition to the factor of poverty that would help guide the grant-making process?
Ms. Everholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, you know, part of the problem is that the school districts don't have access to diagnostic assessment information, and so they wouldn't be able to actually provide that. I know we've also looked at things like number of children who are in the EBD category of a district, also the use of seclusion restraints, because we know that those children probably have a, you know, already have a mental illness and need some additional support and help. But aside from that, it becomes kind of difficult because, again, we don't have that information until we get actually into the schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I love this idea. And I, so far from everything I've heard, it's just gone great because the idea of breaking down the access barrier is really tremendous, very, very important. So thank you, Representative Backer, for bringing this. I had just a few questions so that I can get a better picture of how this actually works. So, and when Dr. Sander was talking, I just wondered, and I have several questions. Maybe Ms. Everholden, since you're sitting there right now, you could answer this first. How does the student actually get connected to the provider in the school? Say that this other testifier's daughter is, has a need. Does the teacher make a referral, or how exactly is that working? And then, secondly, does the school, I assume the schools are providing space for there to be meetings between the provider and the students during the day? Is that how that's working?
Ms. Abbey-Holden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, there should have been a chart in your packet that showed the referral source for students. So 47% were from student services. So that could have been the school counselor, social worker, psychologist, nurse. But 20% was actually from the student or family member, which I think is also important that, you know, a parent recognizes that there's something going on and they need help. But we also have, clearly, primary care providers can refer, general ed teachers, so anyone who's concerned. There is parental permission. I just want to make sure everyone knows that. We're not treating kids without families' permission. But anyone can refer if they're concerned about a particular student. The school building does provide space, and it has actually been very helpful for the mental health professionals to be in the building to see the child in their own milieu and how they're interacting and things like that, which is different than when they come into your clinic down the street or 60 miles away.
Mm-hmm. And then, Mr. Chair, thank you. And then the other question that I initially was going to address to Dr. Sander is how many children can a provider see in a day? I assume that some of them might just be there for a few hours, but I imagine if there's need, they could stay there all day and spend their entire work day in the school. And then how many children would they normally see if that was the case?
No, I don't know.
Dr. Sander.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative. So I think it varies a lot in terms of kind of where we are and kind of what the workforce issues are, and availability. Like in Minneapolis, we have a full-time therapist at a school. So they're there 40 hours a week, and that's basically their office. And so typically, and then they also will vary a little bit by elementary, middle, and high school. Elementary age students, we're in elementary school, they might be seeing 30 to 40 students a year. And so maybe seeing about 20 to 25 students a week, depending on kind of how long they need to be seen for. And the other nice thing about being on site at the school is you can see them for 20 or 30 minutes rather than an hour-long appointment. And for at the younger ages, sometimes having that more frequent connection with the therapist can really actually speed kind of treatment along and skill acquisition. In the high schools, they tend to see more students, so they might be seeing 80 students a year, depending on kind of what's going on. So I think that you're absolutely right. The length of time, they could spend a whole day there. I know a lot of times for most agencies, they have somebody there at least a minimum of a day a week. And sometimes, you just kind of depending on the workforce, it could be and need, you know, full time. I think to your earlier question about kind of how families get connected, I think a lot of schools will go through their student support team. A teacher or anybody can raise a concern. They go to them so that the school employed mental health professionals that might be able to provide a lower level of service can go, oh, wait, no, I'm working with this student. Or going, you know what, I really do think this student really needs clinical treatment, and they can reach out to the family and make the connection and get the therapist and the family connected. So.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to Representative Liebling, I was actually in Duluth this morning and last night, and one of the things that they're looking at with Carleton County and the Fond du Lac reservation is they're actually using telemedicine in some of the schools as well, so that when you have kind of a shortage of mental health professionals, you don't necessarily want them on the road, and they're actually using telemedicine, and that's actually working very well to connect to students as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think this is really so valuable. I really hope that we can fund this because it just seems like this is kind of the sort of thing where we really get bang for our buck, so to speak. And, you know, intervening early, we can just save so much in terms of disability, lives, not to mention dollars down the road. And it's just such an efficient way to get more out of our workforce, really, if you've got, you know, not so much travel time, not so much in-between time and all that. It just seems like a win-win. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I guess you have some questions about how the services are delivered. So am I correct in that the therapists are not there all day? They just come in, meet with the child, and leave?
Dr. Sander.
Representative, no, I think in most cases, the therapist is there at a minimum of probably all day. And so they're not coming. So they're there. In an ideal situation, they're going to be there, you know, half time or more. And so they can really get integrated. And part of what the grant funds help do is really allow them to be better integrated with the school staff so they can consult with teachers. So I'm working with Johnny. I've learned a wonderful way to kind of help him manage his anxiety. I go and come to you, the teacher, and say, hey, here's some tricks that we've learned to help Johnny manage his anxiety in your classroom. And so then not only do you get to help Johnny, but now you've got more information about how to help other students with anxiety. So they're not just dropping in to see a client and then leaving. They're really there, ideally, half-time or more to really be able to integrate and consult with the school-employed mental health professionals, the school social workers, and those folks, and the teachers to really embed the service in that environment.
And I think that would be important that they become part of the entire school experience. You mentioned, though, that some of the referrals are coming from psychologists and social workers that are in the school. Why aren't they providing these services?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine, because they're not clinical staff. So a lot of school social workers are actually not clinicians. Some of the more metropolitan school districts, they are, but in many areas they're not. And so there is a different licensure for that. Same with school psychologists. So we're actually bringing in people who can do the clinical services. They play a huge role, especially for early kind of intervention and things, but this level is for kids who really need that clinical level.
Okay, I guess I didn't realize that they, my wife is a school social worker and she's also a clinician, so she actually does provide these services. I was under the impression a lot of the school social workers and psychologists were clinicians.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine. The other thing I think to consider in this is why this program is different is that a lot of schools are not billing private insurance for services that they provide. Because this is a mental health provider where they bill all the time, they understand HIPAA, you know, they can do all those kinds of things, it actually brings, you know, additional dollars to the table to really meet more kids' needs. So I think there is a difference there. And we've had some families that really have been concerned about that firewall. In some other states, they actually have the schools hire the clinicians, and families have been concerned about HIPAA and what kind of information gets shared. So I think, you know, we did our model this way so that we could have that firewall and so that we could make sure that we're billing both private and public insurance and not related to the IEP.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine. So I think the other piece is the work that your wife is doing is really this early intervention, kind of brief intervention work, which is really important. Because some students, that's all they need, and they're ready to go. And your wife can intervene with them without needing to have parental consent, or they might just talk over the phone, but the family doesn't need to come in, and they can start that work really quickly. And then for that group of students who need a much more intensive kind of clinical level of service, that's what these folks come in. So really what we're doing is filling out the continuum of mental health supports for all students. So individuals, you know, clinicals like, you know, social workers who can do that work in the schools, they can do it, right? Continue to do that work. And we're here to work with those students who have a much higher level need, who really need a clinical diagnosis, a treatment plan, and kind of ongoing parent engagement. So it's really together we're able to serve more students and really the whole continuum of students who need service at different levels.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Backer or Ms. Abdul, I'm not sure who can address this, but I'm looking on lines 1.11 and 1.12 of the bill, and it really speaks to, in terms of while school is in session, I would understand that you probably have bus routes and or other modes of transportation available during the normal course of the school year. But when school is not in session, I'm just wondering, and you mentioned telemedicine and that type of thing, so when it requires the grantee, obviously the school district, to use all available third-party reimbursement sources, is there a hierarchy that you're looking at in terms of how you interact and connect with those individuals, whether it be through telemedicine? Is the school district responsible for sending a bus out and collecting or bringing the student to the school district, or is it a function of the parents providing transportation with mileage reimbursement? I'm just trying to understand what that means in terms of the hierarchy of using all available sources.
Ms. Abdul-Holden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright. So because the school district is busing the child to the school like they normally would, and then the mental health professional is coming into the school to provide that treatment, so we don't have to worry about the school busing the child somewhere else or the parent having to take off of work to transport that child. And the third-party reimbursement is not for the school. It's actually for the mental health provider. So it could be the, you know, Carver County Mental Health Center is actually, they typically bill Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and private insurance, and they would do that for the children that they treat. They would just automatically do it. So it's not the school district billing. This is our mental health providers actually doing the billing to insurance. And we want them to bill insurance before we use the grant funding.
Thank you. Good clarification.
All right. Thank you. And I just had a question maybe for Dr. Sander and or Ms. Koenig, just about how we, you know, from when I was a kid, about how mental health was approached in the schools with special ed and counseling and so forth. It's very different from today. And kids are different. They're better, more accepting, and that kind of thing. But there's still kind of stigma, or some feel a little bit weird about kind of asking for help and getting help, and when do you go during the day, and that kind of thing. And is it being integrated in such a way that that is, it feels really normal for kids to do that, and it feels okay to do that, and how do you kind of work that in, number one, and then number two, is that part of a structure that is copied from building to building, or is that kind of case dependent?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, this is a great question, because I think what we've seen over time is having school-based mental health, school-linked mental health in our buildings has really decreased stigma. And so what we have found, and so to address your concerns, I think in elementary schools, I think, you know, students are like, hey, you know, because our therapists get out and they're meeting, they're providing presentations in the classroom, they're being seen in the building, they're like, oh, that person's really nice. And so they want to go and sure, go see them. We'll send a pass or different ways that the student feels comfortable at being engaged. But in elementary school, you know, pretty quickly there's no stigma. And actually, their friends are willing to come down and meet with Dr. Mark. I mean, those are some of the issues that come up, I think, more often, is other kids wanting to come and talk. I think in middle school, I think that you can get a little bit more sensitivity. But again, as we've been there, students, again, are feeling very comfortable. I think there's a lot more conversation about mental health, and it's a lot easier, and there's less stigma. But I think still some students are like, you know what, if you could give a pass to my teacher, then I'll, you know, there's ways, and the therapist will work with the students, like, how do you want me to get you a pass, rather than coming to kind of the room to pick them up. And then I think in high school, again, you might have more students, you know, maybe not wanting, like, their teachers to know that they're coming in, but like have a pass, kind of manage that. But over time, what we've seen is much more students wanting to advocate for mental health, having things like the Silver Ribbon campaign, where we've actually now got a student organization focused on mental health awareness and those kind of conversations. So I think in the beginning, students are like, I don't know. Pretty quickly, we can allay their fears about, we'll, you know, keep it private, you know, we can figure out, we can do it however you want to kind of get you the pass to get here. But really over time, it's really a stigma reducer.
All right, anything else? All right, let's see. 960 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Backer, as amended. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chair and members.
And with that, we are adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you, members.